When you think of T.S. Eliot, if you ever do indeed think of him, what comes immediately to mind? If you're a poetry nerd, you'll think of The Wasteland, considered one of the most important poems of the 20th century, with its iconic line, "April is the cruelest month," or the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. If you hang out on a slightly lower rung of the nerd ladder, you're likely to have heard of Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. This 1939 collection of cat verses by the cat-loving Eliot inspired the long-running stage musical Cats. Rum-Tum-Tugger, a curious cat. Mr. Mistopheles, the original conjuring cat. Bustopher Jones, the cat about town, and other unforgettable felines leaping from page to stage. The opening poem of Old Possum's Book addresses every cat parent's quandary, choosing just the right name for a new feline friend. Aptly titled The Naming of Cats, it starts like this. The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your holiday games. You might think at first I'm mad as a hatter when I tell you a cat must have three different names. The three levels of cat names, according to Eliot. First, there are the practical, everyday sort of names, such as Peter, Augustus, Alonzo, and James. In the next level are the fancier names, some for the gentlemen, some for the dames, like Plato, Admetus, Electra, and Demeter. Finally, there are monikers that can only belong to one cat in the world. For instance, Quaxo, Bombalurina, and Munkusrap. Most cat lovers would agree that the naming of cats is a sacred responsibility. If you find yourself in such a position and need some help, consider consulting The Complete Book of Cat Names That Your Cat Won't Answer To Anyway by Bob Eckstein, the illustrator of the book you're holding in your hands right now. Precisely. The book I'm holding right now, one that you may want to view too, is titled Inspired by Cats, Writers, and Their Muses. Muses is spelled M-E-W-S-E-S. By Neva Atlas and Bob Eckstein. And you might be asking, don't I know that name, Bob Eckstein? Very likely. Bob Eckstein is known as the world's foremost expert on the history of the snowman, and he's been a guest here on Art Scene, on radio, and on Keystone Edition Arts on WVIA-TV to delight us with what he's discovered around the world about humans and their urge to work with an art medium that falls from the sky. Bob Eckstein is well known for his prolific cartooning career, especially with The New Yorker. He's a regular contributor. The New York Times, Mad Magazine, Reader's Digest, and many others. And so many love his style that blends gentle absurdity, observational humor, and literary wit. Eckstein has written and illustrated a number of acclaimed books. As we've heard, The History of the Snowman, a humorous, researched history of snowmen, Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores, a New York Times bestseller, illustrated stories from iconic bookstores worldwide, and Footnotes from the World's Most Fascinating Museums. He's also edited or contributed to cartoon anthologies, such as the Ultimate Cartoon Book of Book Cartoons. He frequently speaks at bookstores, museums, universities, and literary festivals. And best of all for us, he has a home here in Wayne County. Bob Eckstein stopped in at the WVIA studios in the fall to introduce us to a host of winning cats and their equally quirky writers.
It seems like as the years go on, I always embrace a different topic. And I've been on your show before talking about snowmen. We've talked about bookstores. I had a book a couple of years ago about museums. And now I took on doing a book about how all great writers have been inspired by pets.
There is a pattern here, though, Bob. It seems that you've already done cat names. Maybe with a sequel?
No, once before. Once is enough. A whole book about cat names, I think, it pretty much covers it. And then the success of that book actually triggered this new book, which is called Inspired by Cats. The publisher really liked the last book. People really liked it. And they asked if we could do something else. And I said, let's do something meatier, something with some meat on the bone that would be also tying in writing and books. Something I'm always trying to encourage. I'm always trying to encourage people to read more. I'm actually trying to do a next book to encourage men to read more, because it tends to be a woman's thing now with books. And I don't like that new trend. So the new book, Inspired by Cats, hopefully everybody will like it. And it does have a little bit more information and a little bit about learning about the great writers that we've had.
Number one, if we said name an author and cats, Hemingway, right?
Yeah, so everyone thinks of Hemingway only because he had, well, I think 16 at once personal cats, and then lived on an island in which, this was in Key West, he had a mansion that was covered with cats. And I think the common denominator was that they all had a paw that had three fingers, was it? And so they all had a sort of quirky thing. And that's what he was known for.
He wasn't writing The Sun Also Rises as the cat licks up its milk on the kitchen floor, right?
But it was his companions. A lot of these writers are pretty reclusive, but a lot of them also had a cat by their side to inspire them and then get through the long hours. And you know what I found out in this book? Writers are real characters. They are. You mean, there's some strange people in the literary world.
So you had this idea, let's do something meatier, and the publisher said, yes, because we want more cat content. But how did it turn out to be this, and tell us about your partner?
In this particular case, I have partnered with Nava Atlas. She's a writer I've admired, and she does all these different cookbooks, and her specialty is vegan recipes. And actually, I'm starting to use her recipes now, and I'm really enjoying them. And she's also very funny. She's very talented. And we decided we would try to do something together. At the same time, the opportunity came up about doing something again with cats, maybe with books. And I asked her about it. And I learned that she loves cats. And the other thing I want to mention, too, is I consider myself a good writer. I've been writing for a very long time, but I consider her a better writer. She's very good. How she handled this book, I could not have done as good a job as she did. And so it was really a pleasure to work with her and have that level of quality to go along with my illustrations and have me focus on the artwork. I really wanted this time to do something that was looser, have a lot of energy, and really made the writers even sexier and more, just a little bit more pizzazz. And putting aside the writing chores to someone else gave me a little bit more freedom to do that, a little more focus on the artwork.
To create artwork like that, did you have to dive into the character of the writers you all had chosen?
Well, we learned about the writers as I was doing it, and I was getting a lot of background information, seeing a lot of images of every writer. And in some cases, I'm fans, and I've seen them. And even in other cases, I know the person. So that sort of connection. Now, that wasn't the criteria for a person being included, that they were someone I knew. The basis for this book is great writers. There is nobody in here who doesn't deserve to be in the book. But a lot of people are no longer with us. So in some cases, there are people like Ernest Hemingway and Edgar Allan Poe and other people who are no longer with us. Combined with people who have made a significant inroad in literary circles. And then the final criteria is that all of them have been moved by their pet cat. Now, initially, we were going to do pets in general, but the publishers said they feel like cat people and dog people don't play well together. Let's stick with cat. It seems like as we were doing more research, the cats really were taking over to being the more common muse for a lot of writers. And I did have some ideas for, like, having Raj Chaz, someone I know, have her pet, Her pet was a parrot. Well, the publisher had none of that. I mean, unless we did a whole book on parrots, we had to stick to cats. So the cats was something we had to focus on, and we had plenty to choose from. A lot of people who are great writers and had cats are not in the book. We picked the best of the best.
So when you're approaching creating images to accompany or to support or talk with the narrative about each of the authors, were there many photos or images of the authors with their cats, or did you have to project?
I had to project for legal reasons as well. What happened was that they didn't really want me copying a photograph. They wanted my interpretation. And for legal reasons, that's necessary too, because what we had a little challenge is that they wanted contracts from the photographers when we used photos. Now, I went ahead and did that, but they also still felt uncomfortable that I was simply doing an illustration based on a photo. I get that, but at the same time, I wanted the likeness to be right. So it was a balance. There was actually cases in which my editor and publisher asked me to do the piece over and over and over, and it's because they wanted to make sure that it was very original. And I get that, but in some cases, it was a lot of work. I redid some people maybe 6 or 7 times. Now, in some cases, it was the writers who asked me to redo it. I'm not going to mention a very famous writer who was in the book who we had this experience, but my initial photographs from her and from seeing her in person were as her as an 82-year-old woman. Well, she wanted me to do her younger, and we did it younger. And by the time we got to her 20s and we had photos from then, I had to say, we're going to have to stop here before you start sending me baby pictures. And I understand. As a person who has seen myself in images and stuff, it could sometimes be alarming. And everybody would like to have that image of themselves that they imagine. So my golden rule to making writers happy, and it's a funny bunch, Erica, you know this, is to make everyone 20 pounds lighter and 20 pounds younger. I think that's a good rule for any illustrator, and it's worked.
As we flip through, these are really portraits, as if portraits with cats?
Right, with their cats, from the information we know. Now, there's some writers who gave us photographs with their cats. They had family pictures, and even that, once in a while, there's a case in which we had been given family photo of someone who's been passed along for 50 years maybe, and the family estate gave us permission. But even with the permission, the lawyer said, you know, we would need contracts and stuff like that. And of course, the families don't want to get involved. They're worried about having to sign a contract for the thing. So what we do is, well, I said, I'll do my best to do your interpretation. We'll use the photograph as inspiration. We're not going to be married to it. And this is what illustrators are supposed to do. And at the same time, I did my best to capture the likeness and the spirit of all the different writers. My main goal was to make each of the pages exciting, that you want to turn the page and to capture that excitement. So it's not important that it looked accurate. As a matter of fact, there was a little bit of push and pull among the team, among the writer and the editor, to how loose it should be. You know, everyone's taste is different for art. Some people want, let's just do it realistic, whereas my editor said, I want you to be as loose as you can be. I want to see how you're going to do a picture that no one else could do. And I'm actually kind of from that school, that I'm bringing something to the table that is different, that your experience opening the book is something that you haven't seen that before.
When you think about creating cats alongside or on the laps of or in the presence of these writers, we have an example of Wanda, who is an illustrator, and she studied her cats playing around on the floor with rolled up pieces of paper. How do you know about creating cats in drawings and illustrations?
You know, you stumped me. I don't know how to answer that because I kind of get into a mode that I'm not thinking about it that much. Well, you're asking me for an analytical answer to something that comes out of a state of playfulness. So when I'm doing a rendition of anything, let's forget about a cat, or if it's doing a drawing, let's say, of even a building, I try to find myself in a state of playfulness that I'm going to free myself up and see it in a new set of eyes. So if I'm drawing a cat, it's kind of the same thing. I'm not really going through any particular steps as much as being free, loose, and then see if the results are then matching my expectations. So a lot to do with art and being an illustrator at my level. What my level being is I'm expected to provide professional level work. There's a group of people who are counting on me to come up with a certain level. I have to also not get caught up in that pressure and just, again, find myself in a state of playfulness and just render it in the best way. And then later, I make hard decisions or whatever. Not. Is it good? Is it good enough? If it isn't, then we start fresh. And in the case of my museum book, and I also have a new thing coming out, which is a box of postcards. And this was based on the book Doing Well. People wanted a companion. They loved the drawings. And there's also museums that were not in the book that I felt bad having to cut. So I made this box set to accommodate museums that were not in the book. But in all cases, it's a question of making the right decisions and saying if the work is not good enough, go back. And if I didn't capture the museum's essence, or if I didn't really capture the likeness of the cat just right, that's fine. Did I make the right decision to start fresh? And I just keep going and going until I say, okay, I got that eureka moment where I say, okay, it feels right. But it's a cut feeling.
It would seem if we are going through all of the pages and meeting all the writers and meeting all the cats, that you must have some personal familiarity with cats. Have you had cats in your life?
Oh, I live with a cat that was highly allergic to. So there's it was a sort of a stormy relationship. And, you know, I don't know if you need to say it. I work with a cat. I myself did not have a cat as an editor, as some of these writers do. I get my inspiration from the other people. In the same way, I went like to the museums. By the time I got home, I couldn't wait to sit down and do something because I had just seen a whole day of great artwork. With the cats, it's sort of, if I could please put it this way, it was the relationship that inspired me when I did this book. I was very impressed. I was very moved. And I was very, just in general, inspired that these writers use their cats as their companions, as their editors, and their muse. So that was the point of which gave me a lot of momentum, not the actual physical cat, not the actual books that the writers did, that I said, I love this book so much, and that's what did it. To me, it was about this unusual relationship that I wouldn't have guessed existed because I didn't have it myself, where I couldn't work in the morning until I spoke to, let's say, Mr. Whiskers, and I couldn't get started. I wasn't in that spot. I found this book, though, even just as a reader, if I didn't do the book, I just found it interesting that how much it affected people. Yeah, how much cats really did have an effect on people's career.
You suggested at the start that writers can be quite quirky and interesting people.
Yes.
What is an example of an interesting relationship between a writer and a cat? Now, you mentioned muse and
yes,
editor, but what's an unusual one that we might not guess?
Well, we have one writer who taxidermied his cat and used the cat paw as his envelope opener. That has been actually on display at the New York Public Library. And it's one of the classic writers where I think that sort of behavior was a little bit more accepted.
Okay, so that is quirky.
It might have been quirky back then too. You know, I think that a lot of writers actually express either bluntly or in between the lines that they prefer the company of cats over humans. Some of these writers have had stormy relationships with human beings. Some of them have not had normal relationships where that lasted, and they found themselves surrounded by cats.
We talked about an odd thing with the cat's paw. That reminds us of those who write stories like Edgar Allan Poe, which are quite often gothic. And Poe certainly has been included in this because of not the raven.
Right, because of his cat, Catalina. And he is also, we could consider him a local author. He spent a lot of time in Philadelphia, many years there. And he did not taxidermy his cat. Let's clarify that. That was Charles Dickens. I'm looking that up and I'm reminding Charles Dickens was quirky, but maybe Edgar Allan Poe was quirkier. You know, he's known for his scary stories. his creepy poems, not to be outdone by his own poems. He also married his 13-year-old cousin, and her mom moved in, who was actually, I guess, officially his aunt as well, and the cat, Catalina. And she unfortunately passed away. His wife passed away very early, at age like 24, and then he had big success with the raven. And thank God he picked the raven. I like to say that he picked the right animal, because I don't think it would have taken off if it was a scary poem called The Chicken or The Cow or something. But the raven became his big thing, and he always cites that his cat was on his shoulder while he wrote that poem and other pieces that he's famous for. And this was in Philadelphia, in a small home where he lived with the cousin, his wife, and the mother-in-law, his aunt, just to clarify that. And he passed away very early at age 40, and that was like a mysterious, I don't think they actually solved how he passed away. He was sick. He was also an alcoholic after his wife died, and people speculate that maybe it was suicide. So the big question is, how are we going to turn this interview around to be a little happier and more positive?
I count on you, Bob, to do that, because there are humorous moments in this and writers who are full of sunshine and their cats have wonderful names. We're not going to turn it around just yet, because is it Shirley Jackson who is kind of witchy?
Oh, that's a great example of a Halloween writer. She wrote The Lottery, and you know, she was, I have to say, like some of the backstories about this book that are not in the book is how to get permission and talking to the families of someone like a Shirley Jackson, who deserves to be in the book, but she had passed away. So I wasn't able to interview her directly or get her blessing. So I had to contact her family. And a lot of these families for these offers have set up different memorials and libraries and have archives of these writers' work. I didn't realize, even as a museum expert, how many more museums existed for so many people, you know, that we know, but we didn't know existed. Like Shirley Jackson has a whole thing. There's a society. Like a lot of these people have such a thing, especially in England. A lot of British writers have a society which keep their work alive and keep all their mementos and their birthplace and everything. So I learned a lot about a lot of the writers that not on the surface.
And who was it who left his estate to his cat and to pets in general?
Well, I think you're talking about the beloved Edward Gorey.
That's right.
And you know what's funny about him is I'm being an illustrator and a fan of illustration. You know, he's always been on my radar. I didn't really think of him as a cat guy. But then as I found out, he was very much a cat guy, so much so that he left a tremendous estate. He had a tremendous estate at the end. His work is still very valuable. He started working as a clerk in a bookstore, I believe Gotham Bookshop. That's in mid-Manhattan. Famous place where people used to love to go just to see people watching and the unusual stories. He worked upstairs, I believe, very known as a character there, not known yet as the guy we all know famously as, here's a connection, is the intro to PBS's Mysteries. And if everyone here doesn't know, he does those beautiful little drawings where the woman drops her handkerchief and goes, oh. And, you know, we all know him for that. But he's also come out with these books that are still beloved. People love Gorey books. As a matter of fact, they still go for something at auction, if it's signed copies. So I love drawing him. And he was another example of having a family that had set up an estate and also had a society that kept and preserved his body of work. And it was through them that I was able to get him in the book, because he is no longer with us. Another person was Helen Gurley Brown. And I'm just name dropping that because before I forget that she had the same situation where I had been in touch with the family and they were able to provide rare photos, permission, got their blessing. And in the case of Edward Gorey, I was in love with a photograph that I came across, I think it was from their estate, where he's wearing a fur coat in Times Square. And I changed the photo a little bit to make him a little bit more Gorey, more eccentric, by placing a cat with him walking in Times Square. Now, he didn't walk through Times Square with a cat.
But he might have.
He might have. So we don't know if that's untrue, but what I did was I just took a little bit of creative liberty to combine some of the other photographs that he had of his cats, but I did learn how much he really loved his cats.
The connection you pointed to with Edgar Allan Poe in Philadelphia and the Pennsylvania nature of his time in the city, we also could look at Marlon James, who is alive and well and winning Booker Prizes, and he is a graduate of the Wilkes University Maslow Graduate Program in Creative Writing.
Yeah, and let's just try to explain that he's an important writer. He is someone who I met years and years ago as a keynote speaker at the Writer's Digest Conference. And I believe I sat in the front row in New York City and was just amazed by his whole view of writing and how much he inspired the audience. It was a huge, huge crowd. And I'm saying that because he is a really big deal. And then his name came up again recently at the Milford Readers and Writers Festival. Somebody was pointing out that as they were trying to think of other local authors to bring back, and they said, you know, one of our own, we had a student from here who's made it big. And that's when I learned that Marlon James was educated from this area. But I had already invited him into the book because I was a fan of his work. And I did know how important he was. And he did have a connection to cats. And I was Facebook friends with him. And it was through Facebook that I invited him. Now, I haven't been able to get back in touch with him. I've been trying to let him know that the book has come out. And I wanted to sit and chat with him like we both promised we would one time do. But, you know, that's something that happens so much now. You have a relationship. You make a friendship. You have coffee or something. And you meet up. And all of a sudden, for some reason, you lose them. There was other people from the book that I was hoping to sit down with. Margaret Atwood would be someone I'd like to meet. One person who I have been getting in touch with more now, I'm a big fan of Mark Kurlansky. He's the person who wrote Salt, Cod. Hard to get a hold of him, too. We were supposed to get together for lunch, but he's already off doing his book tour. And so we'll see if we ever cross paths again in New York City. But as you were thumbing through the book, I'm reminded of some of the really great experiences. You turn to Tracy Chevalier, who is a very acclaimed author now. But when I first met her, I didn't even know she was a writer. I met her in Scotland, and she was working with my wife at the Bronte Museum up in, I think it's called Haysworth, Scotland. And that's where the Bronte Museum and house is, where the Bronte sisters grew up. And Tracy was there curating an important show, a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Bronte something. I don't know what the 100 years would have been. Maybe they were there 100 years. I'm sorry, I can't remember that. But my wife was there as an artist contributing to the museum. And Tracy was someone who I met, and we hit it off. At some point, we were walking the moors, dodging deposits left by the sheep in the field. And we got to talking, and that's when I learned that she was a writer who wrote The Girl with the Pearl Earring.
Yes, Vermeer.
And then I had one of my favorite moments of my whole life. I went back to the museum's gift shop. Now, most people go to the gift shop and the bathrooms. That's the two most important questions I've learned when I ask visitors what they like most about the museums. I went back to the gift shop, and I was so proud to see a postcard of my wife's work on display being sold. Next to it was another postcard, and they didn't have many postcards. It was like about six different postcards. One of the house, one of the Bronte sisters. There's like one old famous painting that I used as inspiration and reference for the book. That was a postcard. Then there was my wife's work that was on display in a postcard. And next to it was a cartoon. And this cartoon showed a drawing of the Bronte sisters in the moors, and one of them is being beamed up to a UFO. And the banner, the joke line on the cartoon said, if the Bronte sisters wrote science fiction. And it was a cartoon done by myself. I had not known this. And by total coincidence, our postcards were next to each other, which is I would say, like a lottery odds of that ever happening. So it's one of those moments I remembered very well. And then meeting Tracy, and we've stayed friends. And of course, she's worthy of being in this book. She's an important writer now of historical fiction. And she's just a wonderful person, too.
And they're the Brontes themselves.
Yeah, the three Brontes are here, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne Bronte. And there's a cat. We don't have a photograph of them with their cats because there, I don't believe any photographs of the Bronte sisters.
But they certainly seem like cat writers.
They do. They're very catty. And I think that it's funny. Some people said, well, how come you didn't have Jane Austen in the book? But they didn't have a cat. So next time, if I do a dog book. But all these writers are such characters. I think that's why they're such cat people. You know, they're all quirky and just so bleh. I don't know what to say. They've got a thing that's different. And they see the world different. And it comes through in their writing. The way they could say and describe something is not something the average person could do. They have just this way. They could see a cat, and I come across this over and over. They see a cat as a member of the family, you know, and I understand. But they see it also not just a family member, but their editor and maybe their agent and things like that. So they get an extra step. And it's been really a privilege to become like a part of that community. That writing community, I do feel like it's an honor to say I'm a part of it in some way.
Who is this cat on the cover?
Oh, this would be just nobody in particular because we didn't want it to point out. I initially was it E.L. Montgomery's cat. But then we thought it shouldn't be a specific cat. The cat would get too big an ego. But for those who don't know, Montgomery wrote Anne of Green Gables. And I thought, you know, I tried to do the best amount of research for this book that I could. So I said, well, if I'm going to be doing this, I mean, obviously I have to go to the island where she was raised. And then I found out how inaccessible that place is. It's in Canada, and it's really not a very cheap trip to get onto this remote island to where she grew up. And I want to say it's Prince Edward Island. Does that make sense? I'm not going to remember because I've done different bios of about 150 offers, and I will admit that some of them are starting to overlap. So without the book in my notes, I don't want to be quoted for that, but I believe that that's where she is. And I didn't go, but, you know, like the saying, Mary Tyler Moore once said, you don't have to be a chicken to know where an egg is.
Couldn't have been said better, Bob. One of the things also that's nice, and I'm sure it's in keeping with the nature of the personality of the author, many authors in your images are smiling. They're smiling. Look at Iris Murdoch, for example.
Yeah. No, that's not accidental. I was giving a presentation to a group of people who I was very flattered to be in front of because it was made up of people who are some of them were best-selling authors who had come to hear me talk about inspiration, muses, and what helps make a writer get past writer's block. And I had said something that afterwards people came up and said, thank God for saying that because I think that was like really eye-opening for me, which is people do not buy books or read people's work necessarily for the material at first. They do so because they like the person. Writers who are liked, people will follow them. They will follow them in their books. They'll follow their characters, and they follow them to the ends of the world because it's who they are. And I do feel like it's our sort of like job description is to try to be relatable to other people. Make that connection. That's why social media, the people who are doing well in social media, if I followers, people will sometimes look at their books because they've grown to like that writer. And I wanted to make the writers in this book likable. I didn't want them to be off-putting. I wanted to humanize them. I wanted to make it seem like you will like this writer. And that's why I tried to make them flattering and made them 20 pounds lighter. And we do hope that people get exposed to some of the different works of these different authors. So we included resources in the back so they could follow up and maybe come to learn about some of these great writers. I think we covered everyone in the, you know, was a good cat and a good story.
Bob Eckstein, award-winning illustrator, writer, and cartoonist, speaking with us about Inspired by Cats, Writers and Their Muses. Muses is spelled M-E-W-S-E-S, by Neva Atlas and Bob Eckstein, issued by Countryman Press, an imprint of W.W. Norton. Bob is well known for his prolific cartooning career, especially with The New Yorker, The New York Times, Mad Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, Reader's Digest, and many other outlets. He's written and illustrated a number of acclaimed books, The History of the Snowman, Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores, a New York Times bestseller, and Footnotes from the World's Most Fascinating Museums, and most appropriately, The Complete Book of Cat Names. Bob divides his time between Wayne County, Pennsylvania, and New York City. And for more information and to connect with him, his website is bobeckstein.com, bobeckstein.com, E-C-K-S-T-E-I-N. And then he has a Substack newsletter that he publishes regularly. It's titled The Bob, and it features weekly cartoons, opinions, and behind-the-scenes insights into his creative process. He recommends that you check that newsletter out on Substack, The Bob. You can register for that. And so, again, it's Inspired by Cats, Writers and Their Muses by Neva Atlas and Bob Eckstein, issued by Countryman Press, an imprint of W.W. Norton and Company.